All right, so this is Bio 241. It's Monday, and it is September 22nd. And what year is it? 2008. Now, you might not think that's a really relevant point, but it is real important because, you know, I put your audio lectures online, and they're from the current semester, but the transcripts, which is the text file that is the companion file to the audio, you know, I'm not having anybody transcribe my lecture as I'm speaking, so they're actually from fall 2007. But it's the same information, basically. Jokes are probably different, that kind of stuff. Yeah, what jokes? But anyway, they're from 2007. So if you listen to the audio, the dates are perfect. Everything matches up just fine. But if you read the transcript, the dates are all going to be discombobulated. It's not going to make any sense. But the physiology content is the same. So you can go and look at those transcripts if you wish, but don't pay any attention to the dates and things like that. The testing dates are all going to be different, everything else. All right, so that's just a little heads up. And since we're talking about tests, we're scheduled to have one a week from today, which is September 29th. And I'm going to postpone that, I believe, until October 1st. Which is Wednesday, because we have to get through the next chapter, which is chapter 5, and it's going to take me at least 2 sessions to get through chapter 5, and then, you know what, you got to come to class from here on out, because I might even postpone it one other day, because I just don't know if you can really learn the information that I give you in lecture on Tuesday for a test on, information I give you on Monday for a test on Wednesday. I'm not sure about that. So I might actually postpone the test until the 6th, but right now it's postponed to the 1st of October. All right, and a lot of students said, well, gee whiz, they really know how to study for this class now since their first test is over, and they wish that they would have done a lot better on that first test because they would have known what to study and how to study and all that kind of stuff. But remember, we got a lot of tests in here. We got 5 tests, so you still have a lot of room to bring your grades up. And 2 techniques probably would work a lot, and that is if you were to study with a couple other students, a little study group, and just go over end of the chapter questions, web questions, things like that. And of course, probably even more important or even better would be to study as a group with an SI leader, because SI has also, and actually Ms. Selden, has developed some excellent study guides and worksheets and things like that for you. So I would certainly take advantage of that if at all possible, or at least study with somebody that has gone to an SI session. Okay, so anybody have a question on the schedule or anything? Is everybody able to access the study materials that are important, like the exam figures and all that kind of stuff? I don't know if your question counts, but okay, we'll make it count. Yeah, what's your question? Yeah, Blackboard was down for me too over the weekend, and it finally came back up this morning for me, but not for you. I'll try to follow up and see if anybody from the roll sheet is missing. I'll try to work on that. Okay, the good thing is that you don't have to submit any assignments over Blackboard. But, let me make a quick comment. Okay. Blackboard, of course, could go down at any time. The internet could go down at any time. The textbook website could go down at any time. So don't wait until a couple of days before the test to find those web materials, like the exam figures or the materials on the site from the textbook, because who knows if it's going to be available. Maybe the internet at your house is going to be down for a particular time. Maybe there's going to be a storm or something. You know, who knows? So get to those resources early and try to make copies and just put them on your hard drive or make a hard copy sooner rather than later. But you probably all know that you can't study for this class the night before anyhow. So start studying and accessing the information that you need to do well on the next test sooner rather than later. Yeah. You know what? I've been to that website a number of times, and maybe after class we should look and see, okay? Because maybe you're just doing something not quite right, which I can't diagnose. But I've been there a number of times. But let's just, you and me both together, work and see what the problem might be. And you know what? It's possible that the website is down and it's up when I'm looking at it and it's down when you're looking at it. That's definitely a possibility. So anyway, let's just check it out together. All right, so chapter 4, which is where we're going to start today, is a chapter on enzymes and energy. Yeah, and I can't remember if we talked very much about enzymes in class yet. Let me get my arrow options working here. All right, but an enzyme, what the heck is an enzyme? What's it doing? You should have all of these different kinds of things on the tip of your tongue. And the first thing about an enzyme is that most enzymes, 99.9% of them, are proteins. So what's the building block of an enzyme? Amino acids. They're made out of amino acids. And what's, I think, maybe the coolest thing about proteins compared to carbohydrates that we looked at and lipids was there was some interesting complexity with proteins that we really didn't look at in a lot of these other kinds of biomolecules. Remember, we talked about primary structure, secondary structure, tertiary structure, quaternary structure. That means that the three-dimensional shape of these biomolecules is very important. And we talk about that shape based on what? Their primary sequence and how the primary sequence determines the secondary sequence and how that determines the three-dimensional shape. And if we were to draw a protein on the board and take a picture of it, would that be a very good representation of a protein? For instance, yeah, if I just drew this protein on the board, it kind of looked like this. Well, that's one of my favorite proteins right there, by shape. Would that be a good representation of that protein? What would be a better way of making a representation of it in terms of a graphic representation? A 3D model, yeah, I like that. So we'd be able to turn it around and see the clefts and spaces and divots in the protein. But there's something else too. The best way to show a representation of this molecule would be not to just show it on the board as a picture, but actually to put it on YouTube. What do you have on YouTube? Videos. Because what is a molecule doing all the time? It's vibrating and bending and twisting, right? It's really in motion all the time, depending on what kind of energy. What energy changes the modes of twisting and vibration and bending and all that kind of stuff? The dance of the molecule is determined by the temperature of the molecule. And as the temperature increases, what happens to molecular motion? It increases, right? So molecular motion is directly related to the temperature of a molecule. So proteins are real interesting and important biologically because of their three-dimensional shape and their ability to move around and vibrate. Okay, and all, actually what I said was almost all enzymes are made out of proteins. And they have some very nice activity because of their shape. Okay, so what are we going to look at? Some enzymes, some metabolic pathways, and some bioenergetics in this chapter. So, enzymes are biological catalysts that increase the rate of a chemical reaction. So that, I think you should probably just try to memorize somehow. That's a very important statement. But it's a little bit of a loaded term because maybe you don't know what a catalyst is. Okay? A catalyst, yeah, a catalyst is just something that speeds up the rate of a reaction. And so maybe let's just look at a reaction real carefully, one that you're pretty much familiar with. And let me know if I put this on the board already. So here's a chemical reaction. Does anybody know what this chemical compound is? Maybe I didn't write it on the board yet. This is hydrogen peroxide. For every hydrogen, there's an oxygen, so hydrogen peroxide. You all might have this at home. All right, so what kind of bottle is it in at home? Is it a clear bottle or what? Dark plastic, so that light cannot get into it. Hydrogen peroxide is going to break down all by itself into water and oxygen. So if you've had a hydrogen peroxide bottle in your house for 10 or 15 years, and some of you might, guess what? You don't have hydrogen peroxide in that bottle. What do you have? You've got water and oxygen. Okay? So this reaction will always proceed to the right, but very slowly, all by itself. All right? But you know that you can do something with hydrogen peroxide. What's it good for? Do you want to, like, if you have an upset stomach, do you want to drink it or something? No, don't do that. That won't help your stomach ache. But if you have a laceration and you pour hydrogen peroxide on your skin, what happens? It turns into a volcano, right? It starts bubbling. The bubbles are oxygen. That high concentration of oxygen is a bacteriostatic agent. It's going to inhibit bacterial growth. And all that water that's formed is going to flush the wound out. It's going to flush bacteria out, so it's a nice way to prevent an infection and to clean a wound. Okay, so this over here, this is a chemical reaction that I put on the board. What do we call everything on the left-hand side of the equation? These are reactants. And on the right-hand side, these are products of this reaction. So we've seen this reaction operate under two different speeds. When it's in the bottle by itself, would you say it's fast or slow? Very slow. But when you pour it on your skin, for instance, what happens to the rate of this reaction? Speeds up very, very fast because, and there is an enzyme in our bodies. And we call this peroxidase or catalase. And so you can see that what is the function of this enzyme right here? Does it slow the reaction, stop the reaction, or speed it up? Speeds it up, that's obvious, right? Okay. All right, so that's what an enzyme does. It speeds up the rate of a chemical reaction. It can't make the reaction go backwards. It can't make a reaction happen that doesn't want to happen automatically, but it will speed up one that wants to happen, but it's waiting for something to change. So that's what a catalyst does. That's where this name came from, because this is one of the first enzymes that was looked at. A catalyst just speeds up the rate of a reaction. But in our bodies, we have enzymes that do that job, which are made out of proteins. So we say that this is a catalyst, but it is a biological catalyst because it's made out of protein, for instance. Okay. And with this reaction right here, we see that reactants are converted into products, but the catalyst itself does not change. That's another important feature of a catalyst or a biological catalyst. It does not get changed. Reactants go away, products form, but the catalyst itself stays the same. Doesn't get altered by the reaction. All right, so most are proteins. They act by lowering the activation energy required for a reaction to proceed. So they, like I said, they can't take a reaction that doesn't want to happen, like water and oxygen going back into hydrogen peroxide. An enzyme can't do that, or a catalyst can't do that, but the forward reaction can be sped up. How does that do that? Well, we've got a couple different models to look at. All right, so let's see. Here's this little hill right here. What am I drawing here? That's my MGB, okay, that's on top of that hill. All right, so what does this little car want to do all by itself, even with the engine off? Does it want to roll uphill or downhill? It wants to roll downhill, all right, so thermodynamically that's favorable. But there were probably a number of times when I was up on a hill and I didn't want it to roll down because I never knew about the parking brake. Maybe the parking brake was going to break like the battery and starter motor. So what could I do? I could put like a rock or a log or a chalk or something in front of the front tire, right? And so does the car still want to roll down the hill? The answer is, yeah, it does, but what? It can't because of that little chalk right there. It still wants to roll down the hill, right? All right, so I can come along behind it with like a big bus, for instance, and hit my car from behind, and what would happen? It'd bounce it up over the chalk, and then it would roll down the hill. No problem, right? So in order to get the car rolling down the hill with that chalk, I'd have to put in extra energy to get it to roll. But nonetheless, if I got over that energy barrier right there, I could get it to roll down the hill. No problem. Well, what's a more elegant solution to getting my car rolling down the hill? Should I like hire a bus and hit it from behind all the time? The simplest solution would be to, okay, hire a mechanic, or just take this little chalk away from the front tire, okay, if I wanted it to roll down the hill. So just remove this barrier and the car is going to roll down the hill. All right, so this chalk right here, or rock or something is what we call activation energy for any kind of reaction. For this reaction, activation energy is there. Once we get over it, the reaction will proceed. But what an enzyme does, very nice and elegantly, is that it does what? It removes that barrier so that the reaction can proceed very quickly. Okay, so it reduces that activation energy. So that's a very important statement to have a feel for. It acts by lowering the energy required for reactants to proceed to form what? Products. Okay. So here's a pretty good diagram that's in your book. This shows the number of reactant molecules versus energy of the reactants, and it's kind of a bell-shaped curve. And this, in the first circumstance, where we have some kind of reactant rolling downhill, and remember, this will automatically happen. Here's that activation energy. Well, when the energy is, at this level right here, there's only a very few molecules way out on the right-hand side that have sufficient energy to get over this activation barrier. All right, so these are the only reactants that can form products. All of these don't have sufficient activation energy. All right, but when there is a catalyst involved, look what happens to the activation energy barrier. It is decreased. So now what? You have a much greater proportion of reactant molecules with sufficient energy to overcome this barrier, so you're going to form more products as a result of that. So that's how you should think of activation energy. All right, the ability of enzymes to lower the energy requirement is due to the structure of the enzymes. Enzymes have a highly ordered three-dimensional shape. We call that shape that I erased from the board. That's the conformation. All right, that's based on what? The primary structure, which forms a secondary structure, which forms a tertiary structure. And it has different pockets or surfaces on the enzyme that we call an active site. And that active site is something that matches up with the substrates, and the substrates can fit into the active site. All right, so enzymes act by bringing substrates close together so that they can react. So here we have an enzyme, and I see two active sites. All right, so these are pockets or dimples or grooves or something like that. So it's a depression in the enzyme that can accept a substrate to bind to it. So how would you describe the relationship of the shape of the substrate compared to the shape of this active site? Okay, they're what? They're sort of like inverse to each other, right? Or complementary to each other. They're not exactly the same, because if one had a point, if they were the same, the other would have a point, and they would bump into each other, right? So they're complementary to each other. So if one is a groove, the other is what? A raised surface, so that the substrate can fit into the active site, right? And here is the bend in the enzyme right here corresponds to the bend in the substrate. So the affinity of a substrate to an enzyme is based on its shape, molecular shape. Okay. So let's look at these two markers. And let's just say that these are reactants. And we can conjugate them by putting them together like this. All right, so that's a chemical reaction. Reactants forming a product. Now, how do these reactants have to come together to form a product? How many different ways can these two reactants, bump into each other? Remember, everything is being bumped around. What's determining how fast molecules are bumping into each other? The temperature. As you increase the temperature, they're moving around faster. That's why chemical reactions have a tendency to do what as the temperature increases? Most chemical reactions increase, the rate of a chemical reaction increases as the temperature increases, because the molecules are bumping into each other faster. All right, so in order to form a product, here's a product of these two markers, how do these two molecules have to bump into each other? Can they bump into each other like this? No. Like this? No. Like that? Like this? Like that? Like this? I could stand here all day and show you ways that these two markers can bump into each other but not form a product. How many ways do these two molecules have to bump into each other to form a product. There's only one way, and that's like this. Okay? So if it's just random bumping into each other, that is determined by temperature to some degree, right? So these molecules will bump into each other but won't produce a reaction. It's just futile bumping into each other, right? Until they bump into each other like this, then a reaction will take place. Okay, the beauty of an enzyme is that these two reactants are going to bind to a surface of an enzyme, and they're going to bind in such a way that they're going to come together in just that one way to form a product. And that's why the activation energy is decreased. So instead of all this futile bumping into each other, the way they bump into each other determines that they have to form a product, and only the product that you want. It's very specific. It won't make a product that looks like that, which is really handy in your body, because a product that looks like this could be very toxic, for instance, could be lethal, right? So this is the product that you want. So enzymes are great because they give you, right, 100% product. They don't give you any side reactions that could be very harmful to you. Okay, so let's look at this enzyme catalyzed reaction. Here's the enzyme, which is proteinaceous in nature. And so it's a protein. Here are the active sites. The substrates can bind to the active sites, and there's a model that we use in our mind to describe the association of substrates to the active site on this enzyme right here, and that is the lock and key model. Right? In order for a key to operate a certain lock, what has to be true? The key has to have the correct what? To fit in. The correct shape to fit inside the lock, and furthermore, it's got to have the correct shape so that when you turn it, it matches up with the mechanism on the inside of the lock so you can turn the tumblers. The same thing for an enzyme catalyzed reaction. And what happens when substrates bind, it forms a new molecule. And we call that new molecule the enzyme substrate complex. This has to form before products can form. Right? If enzyme substrate complex does not form, guess what happens to product formation? It stops. It goes to zero. So you have to have the enzyme substrate complex formation before the products can be formed. Okay. And, okay, I see enzyme right here. And I see an enzyme right here. What's the difference between this enzyme before the reaction and this enzyme after the reaction? Who could describe the difference in that enzyme right there? Nasty, nasty trick question. Because there is no difference. They're absolutely the same. So this enzyme can do what? It can catalyze this reaction over again, and over again, and over again. That's another reason why it can speed up the rate of this particular chemical reaction, because the enzyme doesn't get degraded when this happens, just for this one particular reaction. It certainly probably has a lifetime, like all proteins in your body, and we're going to see that it can be regulated. We can turn this one over here, because they're the same, on or off by adding something to it. Okay, but since it's a catalyst, that's just something about a catalyst. It doesn't get degraded in the reaction. Okay, so who's got a question? Anybody have a question yet? Hopefully you've gone over some of this stuff in lab already. Okay, maybe you've heard of some of this stuff. Okay. All right, most enzyme names end with an ASE like I have on the board. Catalase. That would have been a good clue that catalase is an enzyme because the suffix ASE is placed after that word. Classes of enzymes are named according to their activity, such as phosphatases. You know it's an enzyme. Okay, they remove a phosphate. Or there can be kinases that add a phosphate to a molecule. So if we go back, that's one way that we could control this enzyme. A lot of enzymes are controlled by either adding a phosphate or taking off a phosphate that can either increase or stop this reaction being catalyzed by this enzyme. Because when we put a phosphate molecule on here, it's going to change the shape of these active sites. So what's going to happen to enzyme activity if you change the shape of these active sites? Okay, that means you're going to change the rate of this reaction. And if you change these active sites enough, You might change it enough so that a substrate can't bind to it. And if a substrate can't bind to it, you don't have enzyme substrate complex formation, which means what? You don't have any products being formed. So by adding different molecules to an enzyme, that's one way that we can control the activity in an enzyme by turning it on or off. And how could you think of, or why, how could you explain by adding a molecule on one side of this enzyme over here that it might change the active site over there? I don't know if that's very intuitive. Okay. But remember, this shape of this enzyme is just due to all the little hydrogen bonds and covalent bonds and ionic bonds and that whole structure. And if we covalently bond another part onto this enzyme, then it's going to affect that whole, you know, that whole molecule. So for instance, if you're sitting in your chair paying attention, okay, and I take my little tiny little finger like this and I poke you in the side, what are you going to do? Just sit there? No, you're going to move, right? That's going to change your conformation. The same thing, if we bind another molecule like a phosphate group to this enzyme, it's going to wiggle, it's going to bounce in a different way, and that might change this active site right here. Right? And when it changes the active site, it's going to then disallow the enzyme substrate complex to form, and then of course products can't form as a result of that. So that's one way to control enzymes. So phosphatase, you got to remember, that's going to be important throughout the whole class, is an enzyme that takes a phosphate group off of a large molecule. And a kinase is one that adds a phosphate to it. And that acts as a switch for turning that molecule on or off. So it's a way of regulating various proteins in our body. All right, some are named specifically by the substrate of the enzyme and the activity. So for instance, lactate dehydrogenase. What's the substrate that it works with? Lactate. You maybe not have heard of lactate, but maybe in passing you've heard of lactate. How do you develop lactate in your body, or lactic acid? By exercising muscles strenuously produces lactate. And lactate dehydrogenase works on lactate and it takes a hydrogen off of it. And you know that's an enzyme. Why? Because there is a ASE on the end of it. All right. Some other nomenclature. There is a sugar. How about lactose? If we see an OSE on the end of a word, that usually means that it's a carbohydrate. What kind of enzyme is going to break this carbohydrate down? It is lactase. You can't use those words interchangeably because this one is a sugar and this one is a, what is this one? That's a protein. That's a protein. Okay? Yeah, it's the enzyme. All right, carbohydrate, enzyme, which is protein. Okay. All right, so here are a number of important enzymes that are in our body. Catalase, right, breaks down hydrogen peroxide. Hydrogen peroxide is produced by the normal biochemistry of our cells, but is hydrogen peroxide very reactive? Yeah, it is very reactive all by itself. So your cells want to get rid of it because it can become toxic. So there's catalase or peroxidase in cells that immediately break down hydrogen peroxide into water and oxygen, and these are not toxic compounds, so that's good. Where do we find peroxidase? Where do we find peroxidase? That should ring a bell. In peroxisomes. What was the function of a peroxisome? Detoxification. Oh, guess what it's detoxifying? Hydrogen peroxide. Okay, and other kinds of peroxides that a cell will produce. All right, carbonic anhydrase. Is this an enzyme? How do you know? Because you see an ASE on the end of it. It's going to break down bicarbonate right here into H2O and CO2. Have you heard of CO2 before? That is a natural byproduct of your metabolism, right? And carbonic anhydrase is real important for interconverting bicarbonate with CO2, right? And we're going to find carbonic anhydrase in basically all the tissues of your body. And it's one way of regulating CO2, and it's an important mechanism by which your body clears CO2 from its tissues. Let's see. Amylase, it's probably not so important, but amylase can break starch down into maltose. And starch is, what's a building block of starch? Glucose. So it's a glucose bound to a glucose, bound to a glucose. And that can happen, what, thousands of times over? And amylase will break that down into maltose. And maltose is just a two-carbon unit. It's just a glucose. So maltose is a disaccharide. That's what amylase does. All right, lactate dehydrogenase, probably not a bad idea for you to become a little familiar with this, because in the next chapter we're going to talk about this. This will convert lactic acid into peruvic acid, plus some hydrogens. And ribonuclease can take RNA and break it down into ribonucleotides, because ribonucleotides are what? Just a basic building block of RNA. And, okay, so those are important enzymes that you should know. So enzyme activity, the rate its substrates are converted into products, or enzyme activity is the rate substrates are converted into products, and it's going to be determined by, of course, temperature. All right, so here we have a plot of enzyme activity versus temperature, and we said all along that as temperature increases, what generally happens to the rate of a chemical reaction? It increases. So do you see the rate increasing with temperature? Okay, here's enzyme activity versus temperature. It increases, reaches a little bit of a plateau. Okay, because things are getting mixed around in solution, so molecules are bumping into each other faster. But then we get to a certain point, and look what happens. What happens to the activity? It drops. So what the heck is happening here? Why does it drop? Okay, that's a temperature effect. All right, so as we increase the temperature, the molecule is vibrating, twisting, spinning, moving around. And we get to a certain point where we increase the energy of that molecule so much that, I tell you what, have you ever had a spring? And then you pull the spring too much and it got sprung. You never can get it into a spring again, no matter how hard you try to wind it back up. Okay. The same thing for a protein. Some of you maybe can see that. I don't know if everybody's experienced that. But a protein is the same way. It's like a spring. And if you put so much energy into it that you change its conformation, it might not ever be able to go back to what it looked like in the beginning. So here we have oh, where's that protein again? There it is. Okay, so here is a protein that has a certain shape. As we increase the temperature, what's happening to all these things? They're moving, twisting, bending, right? So what's holding this molecule together? Lots of van der Waals forces, a lot of hydrogen bonds, which are what kind of forces? Really weak, right? There might be some ionic bonds, which again are kind of weak. And in a few circumstances, there might be covalent bonds, but not very many covalent bonds. So if we increase the temperature to a certain point, this molecule might take this kind of conformation. It's going to change the shape because the bonds have all rearranged themselves. So now what's the shape of A compared to B? It's just different. But what did we say about enzyme-catalyzed reactions? There has to be, what, some kind of active site that matches the shape of a substrate, right? So if we change the conformation, where's that active site? It's gone. And if the active site gets erased, what happens next? Well, actually, nothing happens next because you don't have the enzyme-substrate complex formation. And if the substrate-enzyme complex can't form, the products can't form. So what's happening here is that the shape of the protein has radically changed, and we call that, this step right here, denaturation, right? That's denaturation. And we use that all the time what do we use that all the time, even at home? To do what? Like to cook a hamburger, like you're going to do tonight on the barbecue. Okay, when you go home, you're going to take a hamburger, which is protein, basically, and you stick it on the barbecue, and can you tell the difference between a raw hamburger and a cooked hamburger? Easy to tell. You can't. No, you're kidding me. Of course you can, right? And that's why we cook it, because it's a lot easier to eat, right, once it's denatured. So You've made this hamburger, you're ready to sit down and eat, and then the phone rings. You didn't take the phone off the hook. And guess who called? Your friends down at the local billiards hall, and they said, hey, a table just opened up, and we have three players, we need a fourth player, so why don't you come down and shoot some pool with us real quick? But you're going to say what? Oh, no, I cooked this hamburger, I'm ready to eat, you know, forget you guys, I'm not going to shoot pool. Is that what you'd say? No, you'd never say that. You'd say, okay, well, I'm going to put my hamburger in the refrigerator, and you go shoot pool, right? So you put the hamburger in the refrigerator, and it gets cold inside the refrigerator. Now, does that protein go back to its original conformation? It stays cooked. It just gets cold, right? Okay, so that's one of the things about denaturation. Once a protein is denatured, it's irreversible, it's catastrophic, it can't go back to its original conformation. So it's denatured, it will forever lose that ability to catalyze reactions. So that's one reason why it preserves food. Right? So even if there's bacteria in there, they're denatured, they can't go back and degrade that protein or have any effect on your hamburger. Okay. So on this curve, we have two different regions. Say from here to here, if we increase or decrease the temperature, we can do what? Forever increase and decrease the activity by changing the temperature. But once we denature that protein, guess what's going to happen to its activity? Even if we go back down in temperature over here, what's going to happen to it? It's always going to stay at zero, no matter what you do. Okay? It's a catastrophic event. Okay, because we've changed what? The three-dimensional structure. So in order for an enzyme to have activity, all right, in order for an enzyme to have activity, what does it have to have? It has to have, what does it have to have? In order for an enzyme to have a proper activity, it has to have, or another way of saying it, in order for the enzyme to have the proper function or activity, it has to have the proper, yeah, the proper anatomy, which is what? Shape. So again, on a molecular level, that's a nice functional structural relationship, even at the molecular level. So in order for these molecules to have the right function, they have to have the right shape. An enzyme has got to have an active site. And we can change the shape of an enzyme or a protein by temperature. We can also change the shape by pH, changing the pH of a solution, because that's going to change the ionization of various components within the protein, which will change the shape of it. And as a matter of fact, you can cook food at low temperature by putting it into different pHs. Who's got a favorite food that you cook not with temperature but with pH? Like ceviche, yeah, which is fish with lemon juice, right? So that's a low pH and that cooks the fish, but it's at low temperature. Never cooked at all. Okay, or sauerbraten, but there's all kinds of examples of different kinds of delicacies that are cooked with pH in that temperature. Okay, so some reactions proceed better at some pHs than others, like proteins are very difficult to break down. Hydrolysis reactions in proteins, hydrolysis of a peptide bond is very difficult and really can only occur at a very low pH, like pH 1. You have that in your body, namely where? In the stomach. Right, and there's an enzyme that can work at that low pH, and that enzyme's name is pepsin. And notice that it will not work at a more physiologic pH or a basic pH. It just won't have. What would you invoke to explain why the activity of pepsin decreases as the pH increases? What changes? The conformation, the shape of that enzyme changes with pH, and therefore its activity. Salivary amylase, we see, operates at more of a physiologic or normal pH 7. That's in our mouth. That's going to digest starch into maltose. And then trypsin is an enzyme that we see in our small intestine. And that's a much more alkaline pH, right, pH 8. So all of these enzymes are optimized to operate at these different pHs. But all enzymes in our body are optimized to work at what temperature? Or they have been optimized by evolution to work at what temperature? Yeah, body temperature, 98.6. So as your body temperature changes, those chemical reactions, the rate of those chemical reactions change, and of course your living processes change as well. So that's one reason why we're controlled in terms of temperature very nicely. All right, well, you can look over this table right here to look at a number of different enzymes and what kind of pH they operate at. But if you see a pH of 9.5, would you say stomach or blood or small intestine? Small intestine is alkaline. Blood is 7.35. Stomach is going to be very close to 1. Okay, that says 2 here. Okay, so we were talking about control of enzymes, or what aids enzymatic activity. All right, so we got two different terms, and they are cofactors versus coenzymes. So we're going to be looking at these different kinds of regulatory mechanisms throughout the class. All right, so cofactors and coenzymes are necessary for normal activity of enzymes. This can maintain enzymatic activity. A cofactor is a very small molecule, and it's a metal ion, such as calcium or magnesium or manganese or copper or zinc or even selenium. Right, so these are very, very small molecules that you need a small amount of in your body. Well, you don't need a small amount of calcium. You need a large amount of calcium. But some of these others are very small. Okay. Coenzymes, on the other hand, are derived from vitamins. And so coenzymes are relatively large organic molecules. Large organic molecules. And they help transport smaller molecules around, which are needed by enzymes. They're like little transporter molecules. So we'll take a reactant from one set of reactions to another. They will actually physically carry a molecule from one reaction to another. That's a coenzyme. So to reiterate, a cofactor is small, inorganic, right? Calcium, would you all agree calcium is inorganic? Or how would you say? Why is that not organic? Why is calcium ion not an organic material? Because what does something have to be organic? It has to have carbon with a hydrogen covalently bound to it, right? So it doesn't have carbon or hydrogen. That's just calcium, plain old calcium. That's inorganic. So small inorganic metal ions are cofactors, but coenzymes are organic vitamins. Who could give me a name of an organic type vitamin? Okay, well, I'm glad you took this class because we'll talk about some. Like vitamin C, vitamin B, right, vitamin A. All of those are large organic molecules. Niacin, okay? Those are large organic molecules. All right, so you're going to have to look at that a couple times over. Well, how can a little cofactor change the rate of a reaction? All right, so cofactor binding changes conformation of the active site and aids in the temporary bonding between enzyme and substrate. So here, what is this little moiety right here? What is this little thing? What complex is it? Well, here is what? Enzyme, right? So, and then we got substrates. So this thing here is what? This is the enzyme-substrate complex. Enzyme-substrate complex. That has to form before products can form. Okay, and what this diagram shows you, okay, is that these substrates can't bind into these active sites right here. They don't have the right shape. But once the cofactor binds in this location, the active site takes the proper shape so that the substrates can bind to it. So even though that's a little molecule, this cofactor binding to the enzyme right at this location, it changes the active site. So what was the little model that I told you to think of? And that is, even if your study partner comes up to you with their little finger and pokes you in the side, what are you going to do? Are you just hardly going to move at all, or what? No, it's going to cause a big change, yeah, in you, right? Okay. All right, so same thing with this cofactor. It can have a major influence on the shape of this active site. So some cofactors can bind to an exterior site on the protein, and some can be actually part of the active site over here, right? Changing it in just the right way. All right, so in each example, what is this, a little red thing? That little red thing is a cofactor, namely an inorganic metal ion. Give me an example of a cofactor. Calcium, that's a good one. Manganese, magnesium. Okay. selenium. Okay. Many enzymes are produced in an inactive form. That means they don't have activity, which is a really good thing. For instance, pancreatic digestive enzymes are produced in the pancreas, but they go to work in the small intestine digesting food. All right, so if they were produced in an active form in the pancreas, what would happen to the pancreas? It would be digested. And that happens, unfortunately, under certain kinds of conditions, and it's really sad. Very, very difficult. Pancreatitis, pancreatic cancer, right? Very, very difficult kinds of pathologies to treat. Okay, so that protects the pancreas from self-digestion. So these enzymes are produced in an inactive form, like a zymogen or pre-enzyme, and then they're transported via tube to the small intestine where they are activated. Many kinds of proteins are activated by phosphorylation. What's the name of an enzyme that phosphorylates something? So if we have, can I duplicate it? Okay, here we have active, inactive form of the enzyme, I mean of this particular, this particular enzyme right here. And we're going to take ATP, and we're going to have a phosphate bound to it, and then we're going to have ADP left over. Okay, so we phosphorylated this enzyme right here, so now it becomes active. What's the name of this enzyme that phosphorylates this protein? Okay, it's using ATP as a donor for that phosphate because it needs energy to make this covalent bond right here. This is what we call a kinase. A kinase. Okay. What do we call an enzyme that will take off this phosphate and make it inactive? Let's just say this is active. Yeah, I did. Inactive. What is this enzyme called? That's a phosphatase. That's from a previous slide. And you know that. How do you know that a kinase is an enzyme? Because you see an ASE on the end of it. Okay, so many enzymes are activated by phosphorylation, namely through the work of a kinase. Others are inactivated by dephosphorylation as a result of a phosphatase. So that's how we control enzymatic activity. And when we control enzymatic activity, what are we really controlling? The rate of chemical reactions in our body, and that is what we call metabolism. We're controlling metabolism by controlling enzymes. Others are activated by ligands, small molecules called second messengers. Maybe we'll give you some examples of this. Okay, so let's look at the rate of a reaction versus substrate competition. And remember, we were looking at transporters before, and we had a similar kind of curve. Right, the rate of product formation increases as the substrate concentration increases. So on our horizontal axis, we see the substrate concentration increasing. What happens to the rate of the reaction? It increases as well. All right, but you get to a certain point where even if you increase the substrate concentration, the rate of the reaction doesn't change. We call that saturation. How would you consider that? How would you explain saturation? What happens when saturation occurs? All the active sites, all of the active sites have substrate bound to them, so there is no further accumulation of enzyme substrate complex because all the active sites are already bound completely, 100% with reactants. And so there can't be any further products produced. So that's one interesting thing that we see, and that is that membrane transporters share a lot of the same properties as enzymes because they all work by binding sites. They all have specificity, they all show saturation, and they can all show competition. So enzymes will only take a certain kind of reactant and turn it into a product. They won't take other molecules and turn them into products because of the shape of the active site. Okay, some reactions are reversible. Both the forward and backward reactions are catalyzed by the same enzyme. And we're going to talk about a pretty interesting law of chemistry right now, and it's called the law of mass action. Some of you might be aware of this as because it's called Le Chatelier's principle. Le Chatelier. Anybody hear of Le Chatelier's principle? Okay. And Le Chatelier's principle just says, if we consider this reaction, and this is the carbonic anhydrase reaction, we got what? Water and CO2 being converted into, well, that's actually carbonic acid. All right, and it can go back and forth. So you see what? An arrow, a double-ended arrow right here. It can go backwards and forwards. Because the energy of the chemical on the right-hand side basically equals the combined energy of all the molecules on the left-hand side of the equation. So there's really no change in energy right here. So this reaction could go backwards and forwards. But what's going to determine which direction this reaction will proceed in? It's very easy to see this. Right? And that is, if we take all of the carbonic acid away, it goes to zero, it's going to force the reaction to the right. So these reactants are going to combine to kind of fill up that reservoir of acid that's been removed from the system. Right? On the other hand, if we put in a lot of carbonic acid on this side, it's going to force the reaction back to the left. So depending on... So there is just a fixed ratio of water times CO2 concentrations divided by carbonic acid, right, that has to be maintained. That ratio is going to be maintained by Le Chatelier's principle. So for instance, let's put in a lot of CO2. Let's keep water constant. Let's put a lot of CO2 in. Is that going to change this reaction? Which way is the reaction going to go? It's always going to force the reaction in the opposite direction from where you add reactants. So if we increase CO2, it's going to force the reaction to the right. What happens if we take CO2 out? The reaction is going to go to the left to build that concentration of CO2 back up again. Okay, what about water? Let's put water into this reaction system. What's going to happen? Which way is this reaction going to be forced? Or will it be forced one way or the other? It's going to be forced to the right if we increase water concentration, and if we decrease water concentration, the reaction is going to be forced to the left to build that water concentration back up. So that is what we call the law of mass action. And carbonic anhydrase just always keeps the balance between all these different chemical compounds just right, right? Carbonic anhydrase. Okay, so let's talk about metabolic pathways. They are sequences of enzymatic reactions that begin with some initial substrate, like A right here, and then progress through a number of intermediates. So here is product number 1, which we call B. And then B is going to be converted into product number 2, which we call C, which will be converted into the third and fourth and finally the fifth product, which we're just going to call F. And each one of these steps is catalyzed by an enzyme. Why do we need enzymes right here? To make it do what? Well, because we said that hydrogen peroxide is going to sit around in your medicine cabinet for 10 years, right? And we don't want a process in your body. For instance, if you want a chemical reaction so that you can lift up a glass with water in it to take a drink, you don't want to wait 10 years for that reaction to take place, right? Okay, so we need enzymes to make things happen more quickly. So we have enzymes to speed up the rate of what? The production of F. All right, so the last product that's formed is what we call the final product or the end product. So this is a metabolic pathway because it has what? A number of different steps in it, catalyzed by different kinds of enzymes. So that's a metabolic pathway. Okay, end product inhibition is a way to control metabolism inside the body. So if we go back to the previous slide, so if we want a certain concentration of F, what do you think should happen to this metabolic pathway when we have the proper concentration of F? Should this metabolic pathway still be producing a lot of F? That would be, well, F for futile, because you have a sufficient amount. But if the concentration of F decreases, what would you like to have happen? You would like to have this enzyme right here start up this metabolic pathway again to produce F to bring it back to the set point, right? So this is what we're interested in, the final product, or product F. So the way that your body controls that is through a process we call end product inhibition, end product inhibition. This occurs when one product in a divergent pathway inhibits the activity of a branch point within a metabolic pathway. And that just prevents the accumulation of the final product above a reasonable level or a physiologic level. And it will cause the favoring of an alternative pathway. So for instance, instead of C being built up, right, it can be diverted to another pathway to produce something else that your body needs. And this usually occurs by what we call allosteric inhibition, where the product binds to an enzyme, causing it to change. Oh, change what? Don't read the rest of that. What happens to an enzyme when something gets bound to it? The shape changes. And if the shape changes, it might not have the proper active site anymore, right, to bind, right, this product right here, which is what we call C. So here we have a metabolic pathway with a branch point in it, starting with A, and if there is little F prime, okay, then enzyme number 3 prime will be active, and it will use substrate C to form D prime and E prime and finally F prime, and F prime then builds up in the cell, and it happens to have a binding site on enzyme number 3, and when it binds to enzyme number 3, then it's going to inactivate this enzyme. And when it inactivates enzyme 3, what happens to a further buildup of product F prime? It stops. And when that happens, right, then this product C can be converted into D with another enzyme, and then to F, and then to F. So your body can switch between different pathways at these branch points by what? End product inhibition. So that's going to change the active site when a product binds to an enzyme. We call that allosteric inhibition because of the binding of the final product to this enzyme right here. Okay, I don't think I'm going to talk about this slide. Or that slide. Okay, those last two slides. Yeah, as far as errors of metabolism, if you have a couple questions maybe at the end of the book or in the web, you probably should be familiar with those questions, but I don't think I have any questions on the web regarding inborn errors of metabolism. All right, so let's move on to bioenergetics. This refers to the flow of energy within living systems. So energy can flow just like fluid can flow. And we have a couple laws, and I'm sure you guys have talked about this in lab already, but I think it's good to have a little bit of a review on these topics. And you've also, there's a third concept here, and that is the conservation of matter. Okay, conservation of matter in terms of chemical reactions just says that if you, on the right-hand side of a chemical reaction, if you have hydrogens and oxygens, what do you have on the left-hand side of that reaction? That reaction, you have hydrogen elements and oxygen elements, right? You don't have like silver over here and potassium. We can't convert elements from one kind to another, right? They have to be the same elements. What do you call that if we were to? I picked a really that's silver. Ag is silver. That would be okay. I'd be happy if I could do that. Okay, what is this discipline saying that we could actually create a different element on the right-hand side of a chemical reaction compared to the left-hand side? It's fallen out of favor because that's called alchemy, right? There were many people that spent their whole life trying to figure out how to make gold out of various different kinds of compounds, right? But you can't because why? The law of conservation of matter. You can't do that. That just never happens without some kind of nuclear reaction. Okay, so the first law of thermodynamics states that energy can be transformed but cannot be created or destroyed. So we can take one form of energy and transform it into another kind. So I could take some kind of energy in the form of ATP. What form is energy in ATP? You haven't thought about this, so I don't know if you could answer that question, but it is chemical energy. That's a chemical. So there's energy in the chemical bond, the covalent bond of ATP, and we can convert it into other kinds of energy. Like what kind of energy? Like mechanical energy, like I just did. I can use ATP in my biceps muscle to get it to shorten, which is going to move my forearm back and forth. So energy can be used, right? Chemical energy can be converted into mechanical energy. What's another good example of taking chemical energy and converting it into mechanical energy? You all probably took a device like this, used a device like this maybe this morning. Where you took chemical energy in the form of gasoline and you converted it into mechanical energy in your car with those pistons inside your car, and that transported you to school or to work. So that's converting chemical energy into mechanical energy. What's another conversion? Who can think of another kind of conversion? Huh? Kinetic energy. Kinetic energy can be converted into, I could think of like electrical energy, right? And that's a power plant. That's taking some kind of motor that's turning and that produces electricity, and then, you know, they ship the electricity all over the place so that you can use it, right? So that's a conversion of energy from one form to another. So chemical to mechanical. We could probably think of ways of taking mechanical into chemical. Okay. Okay, I'll point some other kinds of transformations out. All right, the second law just states that energy transformation will always increase entropy. That's a degree of disorganization in a system. So if we have a balloon with high pressure, all the molecules are touching each other, it's highly organized, and then we let all that air out of the balloon, what happens to the pressure? Will the air flow out of a balloon? Yes. Because it's going to flow into the room that's a more disorganized state. So air will flow out of a balloon very easily because the entropy or the state of organization is increasing as it goes from high pressure to low pressure. Okay. And only free energy, that is the energy in an organized state, can be used to do work. So in order for you to use that energy, that free energy, okay, let's look at ATP. All these molecules are arranged in a very particular way in ATP. How could we increase the disorganization, or how could we increase the entropy of ATP? We can take ATP and convert it into ADP plus inorganic phosphate, and now we have these two molecules. Okay, so this is less organized than this state right over here. It's the same atoms, but there's more disorganization in these two molecules than there is in this one right here. Okay, so this happens automatically, okay, because entropy is increasing, but we're going to see that your body does make ATP. And we can couple this reaction to another reaction to make ATP. All right, so what is... Here's a question. What is energy? What is energy? Probably, oh yeah, some people, maybe you would have to take like a physics class to have that on the tip of your tongue. I'm not sure. But energy, now I usually get a lot of groans when I hear this. Energy is the ability to do work. Okay, that's what energy is. So when you're feeling very energetic, what does that mean? You can do a lot of work. Right? If you're not very energetic, okay, then you don't have the ability to do work. But what's an example of work? Like running up the stairs, okay? That's what I mean by work, okay? Lifting things, moving things around, that's work. In order to do that, what do you need? You need energy for that to happen. And what's the energy molecule inside our body? That is ATP, right? So when you have a lot of ATP in your body, you have a lot of ability to do work. Okay. Okay, so the second law dictates that all living organisms require continual input of energy to stay organized. Human beings are very organized, right? So we're the opposite of entropy. But in order to maintain that, we need energy. Where does all the energy come from that our body uses? It basically has to come from the sun right here. So this is just a little bit of biology, not really so much physiology. Okay, plants obtain sunlight. Okay, so what kind of energy is that? That is just, that's just light energy from the sun. And there are special molecules within plants, okay, that can absorb that energy. And they can take CO2 and water and put them together to make glucose. All right, so it takes this light energy. So again, that energy is not created by the plant. It just absorbs the energy from the sun. And in so doing, it produces oxygen. All right, so that's where glucose comes from, just all these plants. So what's the color of that chemical that can absorb sunlight and make glucose out of it? What's the name of that chemical? That's chloroform, not chloroform, chlorophyll. Okay, chlorophyll. Chloro is green, kind of pigment. Okay, so that energy the plant absorbs, which is sunlight, is used to make higher free energy glucose molecules from CO2. So we're putting these molecules together, right, to form this. So there is a lot less entropy in this glucose. So the plant is giving off oxygen as a result of that. And then animals have to consume plants, and we acquire this energy in the form of glucose. Right, so that's where our energy comes from. And then we have organelles inside our cells that can take glucose and convert it into, I can't get down here to the board, right? Can use the energy in glucose to take ADP and inorganic phosphate and make ATP out of it, right? And in so doing, what does our body produce? Right, animals produce CO2 and oxygen, and that kind of completes the cycle. Okay, so you probably should have a feeling. Is CO2 an important compound to have in the atmosphere? Yeah. As a matter of fact, it is rate limiting for photosynthesis. Okay. Well, let's talk about endergonic versus exergonic reactions for a little bit. Endergonic reactions require input of energy to proceed. That means that the products contain more free energy than the reactants. Exergonic reactions, on the other hand, release energy as they proceed. That means that the products contain less free energy than the reactants. So we have a graph here of free energy versus, oh, this is like a time axis right over here, so energy versus time. And the energy molecule that we have that has the highest energy, right, so this is the Gibbs free energy right here, is glucose. Okay? So our bodies take in glucose, and then it is broken down. And through this multiple step reaction right here. And so we call, what would we call this? What do we call a chemical reaction with many steps, with many enzyme catalyzed reactions in between? That's a pathway, a metabolic pathway. And in this pathway right here, where glucose is completely broken down into CO2 and water, we're going to see that there's three important pathways in our body. That's for the next chapter, but I thought I'd maybe just tell you about it. There's three important pathways. Okay, so the energy, the free energy in glucose, can be used in some of these steps right here to produce ATP. And this is what we call combustion. Otherwise, we could take glucose and convert it all in just one step into CO2 and water. How could we take glucose and convert it just all at once into CO2 and water? We could, yeah, just light a match underneath a sugar cube or something, right? And it will burn. And it will turn to carbon dioxide and water, but that won't give anybody any biological energy. We don't take the energy from glucose in that particular way in our bodies. Okay, so we have a couple reactions that I want to look at right here. We said that taking inorganic phosphate plus ADP to ATP, is that going to release energy or take energy? That's going to take energy, right? So this is what we call an endergonic reaction. And most endergonic reactions are not spontaneous. Okay? So how are we going to make ATP? Because it's essential for our life in order to make ATP. It requires energy. Well, we have to couple that reaction to a process that's going to release even more energy. All right, so let's look at these two gears that I have on this slide right here. Okay. Ooh, dark blue, light blue? Okay. The light blue wheel right here, okay, is an endergonic reaction. All right, going from low free energy to higher free energy, or Gibbs free energy. All right, could you give me an example of a chemical reaction that is operating like this little light blue wheel right here, an endergonic reaction? All right, and let's forget about the big blue one, the dark blue one. Let's just take it off the slide. Will this wheel turn all by itself? It won't, because it's endergonic. All right, and a good example of that would be what? What I have right on the board right here. Inorganic phosphate plus ADP being converted into ATP. Okay, it just won't happen automatically, but we can couple it to another reaction or another set of reactions that's symbolized by this big dark blue wheel. Okay, so if we take the reactants that have a whole lot of free energy and convert them into products, and we can get our hands on that free energy, right, we can turn the smaller blue wheel and we can actually take low energy reactants and convert them into a high energy product. As long as what? There is additional energy, the difference between this height of the wheel and this height of the other coupled reaction right here, as long as we have energy to give away as heat or something that increases entropy of the system. Okay, just like, for instance, did I ever draw a feather down over here once and put it on that trolley? What happens if the feather was the same weight as the car? Nothing would change, right? You have to have more energy uphill to drag that light feather up the hill. The same thing for coupled reactions. There has to be excess energy that can be used to increase the entropy of this system right here. So they do this by coupling, okay, coupling reactions, and we're going to look in the next chapter how reactions are coupled to each other. All right, by coupling endergonic reactions to exergonic. So exergonic reactions will happen spontaneously. Endergonic reactions won't happen spontaneously. All right, and most exergonic reactions, namely this one right here, where reactants start at high energy, proceed to low energy, most make ATP in our body. All right, so what about ATP? What does it look like? Well, here is ADP plus inorganic phosphate. Here is a nice diagram of ATP. And we can see an adenosine molecule. And this is a ribose sugar. And it's bound to three phosphates. All right, and so when I write inorganic phosphate on the board right here, okay, what do I really mean? It's not just a phosphate atom, but it's a phosphate with all these oxygens, and you can see it's highly ionized state right here. And this covalent bond between the terminal phosphate and this oxygen is a high energy bond. It's even a higher energy than these regular covalent bonds right here. So when it is broken, it gives off a lot of energy that can be used for cellular processes. And even this energy between ADP and AMP, monophosphate, that's a high energy bond. But adenosine monophosphate by itself, namely this bond right here, does that look like it's high energy? The energy in AMP is not high energy. Okay, it's only the last two terminal phosphates where there is high energy. Okay, well, you sort of have to, I guess you're sort of familiar with this, because You could tell this was a ribose and not a deoxyribose, right? Because there is an oxygen right there. Okay. Okay, oxidation-reduction reactions. This has to do with electrons. Where did you find electrons before? Anybody familiar with an electron? They're opposite what? Protons. Where do you find protons? In the nucleus of an atom. Where do you find electrons? In orbitals or shells. Okay, so those electrons can be shared, right? Or they can be donated, depending on whether it's a covalent bond or ionic bond. So electrons can hop around from one molecule to another. Okay. And if a molecule gains an electron, we say it is reduced. And if a molecule loses an electron, we say it's oxidized. And they always go together. Why is that? Because when one molecule loses an electron, another one gains that electron. So they always go hand in hand. So one molecule is oxidized and one is reduced in the process. And that chemical reaction, we call it an oxidation-reduction reaction based on that electron hopping from one chemical to another. So there are a couple little sayings. What's Leo? Leo is, mythologically, is what? A lion. What do lions do? Grr. Okay? Leo, grr. Is that right? Lose electrons, oxidation. Gain electrons, reduction. Okay, so you could just, did I do that right? Do we have any chemists in here? Or you could do oil, rig. Let me see if I can figure this out. Oxidation is to lose. Reduction is to gain. So as long as you don't freak out on a test and you get time, you can figure this out. But it is a mind teaser. All right. So and it might not be crystal clear the first time you look at these kinds of reactions. All right. So a reducing agent, right, a reducing agent donates electrons and an oxidizing agent accepts electrons. Reduction and oxidation are always coupled reactions, I said that already. Often involve transfer of hydrogens instead of electrons. Well, that's sort of not true, but it's sort of interesting because we could have a reaction where an electron goes in this direction. Okay, see this electron going in this direction? So if an electron goes in this direction, does this over here, does this get more positive or more negative? This area right here. If this electron leaves and goes over here, what happens to this area? Becomes more positive, right? So this reaction really is the same as what? A hydrogen ion going the opposite direction. But in terms of this class, what I really want you to focus on is not these, so forget that hydrogen. And your book makes a big deal of hydrogens and you see where it might make sense. But what I really want you to concentrate on is what? The flow of electrons and not the flow of hydrogen ions or protons. Okay, so you know what? When we come back on Wednesday, we will finish starting with this slide right here. Okay? All right, well, I would start working a lot on this chapter and also on the next chapter. Okay? Because you got to get as much as possible out of these lectures. So come with a lot of questions. Yeah, question. The test. What did I say about the test? Postpone one day. So instead of on... instead of on Monday, it's Wednesday. But I might postpone it into one more day. Okay. Yeah.